Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania typically leads the nation in the number of confirmed cases of Lyme disease, which is transmitted to humans by the bite from an infected black-legged or deer tick. But Lyme disease is spreading into areas and regions where it and ticks didn't exist not very long ago. Could it be because temperatures are warmer in those areas due to a changing climate and allowing ticks to thrive? As you'll hear today, Lyme disease is one of, if not the most controversial illnesses doctors do or don't diagnose. Joining us is Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She's author of the new book, Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. Ms. Pfeiffer, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment, maybe tell a story on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Ms. Pfeiffer, I want to start off by reading the audience and getting you to respond to a passage from the news release about your book, because I have to say that it really makes an impression on you. They are crossing continents and climbing mountains, are hatching invisibly by the billion, and are carrying diseases that may be coming to a neighborhood near you. As ticks move into new areas and enjoy longer seasons, they are changing millions of lives, driving up healthcare costs, and infusing a simple walk in the woods or picnic in a city park with fear. I kind of pictured like the hordes climbing the mountains back during the days of Genghis Khan. That really gets your attention, and it's kind of a frightening way to describe what's going on.
It is a very frightening situation that we are facing these days. In fact, a scientist who endorsed my book likened it to a Stephen King novel.
Oh, really?
Only the scarier thing is that it's true. We do indeed have an army of ticks moving around the planet, doing something that they didn't do just a few decades ago. And we have scientific data that attests to this, that shows that ticks live in places they didn't live before, mostly in places that were too cold for them to once survive. We have data, for example, showing what one scientist called altitudinal expansion. Namely, they're moving up mountains. That's one way that we can document that they're moving to places that were once colder. In the Alps, for example, they could survive in the late 1950s at 800 meters. Well, scientists went back about 40 years later, and lo and behold, they were at 1,200 meters. So we have a couple of ways, a couple of examples of them moving up mountains. But beyond this, we also have archival data in Sweden, for example, that shows they were just in this sort of tight cluster around Stockholm before 1980. Now they have moved very far north and west, inland in the country, and there's just pretty broad agreement that climate change is allowing ticks to move to many new frontiers around the globe.
In the book, you write about an Environmental Protection Agency report in 2014 that there were four indicators that EPA listed of how climate change would have an impact on the United States. Actually, Lyme disease was one of those indicators. What did EPA have to say about that?
EPA has basically since 2014, as you say, added Lyme disease as one of the health indicators of climate change. In other words, we only look at a couple of health outcomes, things that we see happening in the population to gauge the movement of climate change. We look at ragweed pollen, for example, whether the seasons are getting worse over time. We look at health-related deaths. That's another way that we can tell more people are dying because it's a lot warmer. We have these very, very intense heat spells. But in 2014, the EPA surprised a lot of people when it added Lyme disease as the only disease it tracks to gauge the movement of climate change. Now, whether they're still doing that or not, I don't know, because as you know, climate change is highly politicized in our government and, in fact, denied it at certain levels of government. Be that as it may, this is one of the indicators officially of climate change movement in the United States.
There was a passage in your book that I have to say that if people had a weak stomach, they may not want to picture the images. The deaths of moose in Maine. And Maine and Vermont are two of the states where Lyme disease has grown the quickest over the last decade or so. But the deaths of these moose in Maine, just incredible. I'd never heard of anything like this.
Yes. Ticks are taking a huge toll on moose. I would add here that this is not the same kind of tick that bites people. It's called the winter tick that is being found by the 100,000 sometimes on moose. But it is an indicator of a problem in our environment, an imbalance. And the rise of these winter ticks is similarly tied to climate change. It's a lot warmer out there. There's a lot more of these winter ticks. The other thing that comes into play is that moose need cold weather. They thrive in the cold weather, and they become very lackluster, and they lose their energy when it's too warm. So they've got the two things working against them, the warmer climate, as well as the fact that many of them are carrying thousands upon thousands of these ticks, so many of them that they actually bleed to death. The ticks can take up to half of their blood volume and cause death in moose. It is truly a horrifying picture that's going on out there in nature. And it's not just in the Northeast, it's also in the Midwest, where they say moose may be extinct in a very short period of time.
Just due to these winter ticks?
Yes. I mean, there are other things that certainly come into play. You know, we have an adulterated environment, a polluted environment to some extent, but this is believed to be the key factor that may actually, undo the populations of ticks, of moose in particular, in the Midwest.
You're an investigative journalist. What was the impetus for writing this book?
Well, that's a good question. I had lived for 30 years and reported for 30 years in the Hudson Valley of New York, which has among the highest Lyme disease rates in the world, literally. And I was really aware that there was a problem with Lyme disease. I mean, I had gotten it. Family members had gotten it, though not terribly out of control kind of cases. So I sort of embarked on it in 2012 with the idea of looking into why there wasn't a vaccine for Lyme disease in people, that is. We do have one for animals. I was shocked when I embarked on this research to find out how controversial a disease this is, how many people remained ill after being treated, how many people couldn't get diagnosed initially and had to wait for treatment, how many people couldn't find doctors to treat them. So I went into this intending to write one story, having lived in an area with a lot of Lyme disease, and I wound up writing an entirely different one about, frankly, an epidemic that has been greatly underestimated.
And we're going to talk about that throughout the program. But I described it as controversial. I mean, I will say from experience, there are TV and radio shows that I've produced and hosted over the years that when this topic comes up, it is very controversial. Why so controversial?
The key thing, the key issue about Lyme disease that feeds this controversy is whether or not people remain infected with the Lyme disease bug, the pathogen called Borrelia burgdorferi, after they're treated with antibiotics. That's it. And the mainstream medical community, if you will, maintains that a short course, usually 10 to 28 days of antibiotics, will kill that bug in your system. There are other people who totally disagree with that, and there's some science, frankly, a lot of emerging science, to back that up. But, you know, it is accepted in the medical literature, regardless of whether you believe the pathogen persists after antibiotic treatment or not, it is well documented that a share of Lyme disease patients will stay sick, even after they're treated. So whether they are actively infected or not, we need to pay attention to what's going on in this group of people. And because Lyme has become so controversial, because there is this hardened belief in the mainstream medical community that has been really fostered by the CDC, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and medical societies, we more or less have written off, have failed to pay attention, have failed to try hard enough to figure out why people stay sick. You know, I will acknowledge that there are two sides to this story for sure. You know, are they infected? Are they not? But they are still suffering, and we need to find out why.
You know, and there are a few questions, obviously, that that surround why it is so controversial. But the CDC, the Infectious Disease Society of America, which is basically a society, an organization of infectious disease doctors across the country. You know, these are two very reputable organizations. Why wouldn't they, if there are so many people who are saying that they're sick months or years after they've been treated for Lyme disease with antibiotics, why would they continue to deny that it can be a chronic disease?
Well, there's a few reasons for that. The first that I would venture to say surrounds diagnosis of Lyme disease. The test for Lyme disease, it's a little bit like asking a woman if she's pregnant. You know, you either are or you're not. But with the Lyme disease test, you have to meet a certain threshold in order to be declared positive for Lyme disease. You have to have a certain load of antibodies on the first test that they give you. If you achieve that load, then you go to the second test, in which you have to have two of three kind of markers that they look for at one stage of the disease and five out of ten in another stage of the disease. It is, if this sounds confusing, frankly confusing for people in the laboratory community. There have been a lot of studies showing that this test is technically challenging, that from lab to lab, the results of the same blood sample may change, that the outcome of the test is variable according to the commercial variety of the tests that you use. Anyway, the bottom line is that the test is unreliable, very unreliable early in the disease, and somewhat more reliable later on. And by somewhat, I mean by the time you get to the late disseminated stage when the organism has moved throughout your body, it is perhaps 87 to 100% accurate. So it still misses, you know, potentially one in seven or eight cases. And that's a very large portion of people when you consider that 300,000 people are infected in the United States every year. Another flaw of the test, and this is key to this discussion, is that it does not distinguish between active and past infection. Now, you probably know, living in Pennsylvania, people can get infected multiple times.
Talk to many of them.
Right. So you may go to the doctor. The doctor may test you. You may come back positive, and the doctor will say, no, that's a false positive. You have antibodies from a past infection, so we're not going to treat you. And doctors, by the way, have been warned of repeatedly of falsely diagnosing Lyme disease. There's 30 papers I found in the scientific literature about overdiagnosis of Lyme disease. I could only find five of underdiagnosis of Lyme disease. So just bringing this back to the controversy, we don't know who has Lyme disease and who doesn't. We cannot say with certainty that the people who are still suffering are suffering because they're infected or not, because we don't have a good test to tell us.
But again, I go back to the CDC and the Infectious Disease Society. Why, and you know, you write in the book, actually, where some medical professionals look at people. I think you quoted one who said that one of the reasons he was glad he was retiring is that he was happy to get away from the loonies who claimed that they had chronic Lyme disease. That, I mean, this, they look at this as people who say they have chronic Lyme disease, that it is all in their heads.
Yes. Well, and that is ironic because, you know, there is data in the literature that is accepted and in some cases authored by people in the IDSA, people in the Infectious Diseases Society who crafted the Lyme guidelines. They do accept that some people remain ill. But there is this great tendency to minimize those symptoms. For example, in the 2006 guidelines for Lyme disease care of the IDSA, and those, by the way, have not been updated in 12 years, they refer to symptoms of people who have been treated but still feel poorly as, in many cases, being, quote, the aches and pains of everyday living. This is one way that the problems of post-treatment Lyme patients have been minimized. And the what you referred to about the quote-unquote Lyme loonies, that characterization was by a National Institutes of Health Lyme disease officer on his retirement. He wrote that in an email to another scientist in the Centers for Disease Control. He said he'd miss the job, but he wouldn't miss the Lyme loonies. And a lot of that goes back to the controversy, to the ways in which people with Lyme disease have tried to assert themselves, and sometimes they have done so perhaps in ways that have angered bureaucrats and, reflected poorly on them. I would say that's a very, very small proportion of people. Most are very measured in their responses, and they just want government and medicine to consider their plight seriously, which they should.
We're going to take some phone calls and talk more with Mary Beth Pfeiffer in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WYTF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest today is Mary Beth Pfeiffer, who is author of the book Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. It was just published. If you have a question or a comment, maybe a story to tell, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@wytf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WYTF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWYTF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Jim is in Enola. Jim, you're on the air. Hello, Jim.
This is a great topic, and I agree with pretty much everything your guest has said so far. It seems to me there's a lot of confusion out there. There's no question ticks are a big problem, and Lyme disease is a big problem. But we need to separate the stuff that we aren't sure about, like whether or not it's chronic and all that kind of stuff, from the stuff that we do know will help you to prevent you from getting Lyme disease. I tell people there are three things that you can do that will go a very long way towards making sure you don't get Lyme disease. One is use permethrin on the clothes that you hike or otherwise use outside. So use permethrin. You can get permethrin in any sporting goods store or outdoor equipment store. Second thing is use a good insect repellent I prefer DEET. Some people don't like DEET. The third is, as soon as you come in from the outdoors, check yourself thoroughly for ticks. If you follow those three things, you're very close to 100% sure that you are not going to get Lyme disease. So thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for your call. Mary Beth, you agree with that?
I certainly do agree with that. We need to do everything we can to prevent this disease, because once it gets out of control, it is can be an awful, debilitating illness. So, you know, let's be proactive. I recommended permethrin impregnated clothing myself. I sprayed my socks and shoes and that of my husband and my grandkids a couple of weeks ago. I think it is a safe product. I did a lot of research for my book on permethrin. We also do need to, on occasion, use repellents, much as I don't like them as well as many other people. I do use them. I don't like the way they smell. I don't like the idea of putting a chemical on. But, you know, in the risk-benefit, calculus that you do here, we need to be proactive against ticks. But, you know, the other thing is we really have not responded to this epidemic as a society, as a government, in the ways that we should have. We're 40 years into this, and the ticks are way, way ahead of us. The ticks hold all the cards and all the power in this picture. And we need something on the order of an AIDS-like response, a Manhattan Project response. You in Pennsylvania are seeing a doubling of cases since 2012 alone. I mean, that's huge. Every year, it's just sort of a steep upward climb. So we have to start learning and figuring out ways to reduce the numbers of ticks in the environment. That kind of research has been going on for a while, but it really hasn't come to the point where we're taking measures to control ticks, to control their spread.
There are so many questions. I do want to take a step backwards in a few minutes and talk about symptoms. And when you describe Lyme as debilitating for some people, some of those symptoms. But before we do, since you brought up a Manhattan-type project or a lot of research, in the book you made comparisons with the U.S. government's response to Zika a couple years ago compared to how the government has responded to Lyme disease. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, for some reason, mosquito-borne diseases have always captured the public imagination and, by extension, the attention of our bureaucrats in government. And you probably recall during the Summer Olympics in Brazil in 2016, there was an awful outbreak of Zika in which babies were being born with horribly deformed heads because their mother had Zika during the pregnancy. And then Zika, in short order, turned up in southern Florida and in parts of Texas. In 2016, there were 224 cases of Zika that were contracted in the United States itself. Well, very soon after that outbreak in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control gave out $184 million in grants for Zika research. That was an amazing amount of money, first of all, and it was an amazing allocation that swiftly went through Congress and was passed, adopted, and made available for researchers. Okay, so in 2016, we give Zika $184 million, 224 cases. That same year, the CDC gave less than $3 million for Lyme disease. And, by the way, there were 300,000 cases. Now, that's not the only money that our government spends annually on Lyme disease. The National Institutes of Health spend about $24 million a year, but it is nowhere near the amount of money that is spent on Zika and other mosquito-borne illnesses. So, you know, there just needs to be some parity here. I'm not saying that Zika is unimportant. This is something we do need to pay attention to. But, you know, ticks don't fly. They don't move very far in their lifetime. They just kind of crawl very slowly up a blade of grass and just wait for people to pass by. And somehow they have been ignored for too long in terms of their potential to cause great damage to people.
One of the things you write about in the book is not only warming temperatures, but how we live today, that it used to be that there were ticks deep in the forest, but that's not where they are now because of how we've developed where we live and how we live. Talk about that, if you would.
There was a study at the Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies, which is in my area here in the Hudson Valley, and they looked at bits of forest, these small kind of forest fragments, we call them, that are very common in suburbs and in other, you know, exurbs, areas where I live, small villages and so forth. And they actually found that the smaller the forest fragment, the higher the population of infected ticks would be. So basically what we have is an environment that is no longer in its natural state. We've lost species. For example, mice play a huge role in infecting ticks. They are the number one mammal that a baby tick goes to get its first meal and to become infected. That baby tick then turns into a nymph, which often infects us. But in the loss of species, we don't have as many foxes in these small forest fragments that would ordinarily keep the mice under control. So what we have is this sort of perfect storm of conditions. We have an adulterated environment, an environment that is out of balance, that is really propagating mice and these pathogens that they carry. This is great for ticks. It keeps ticks going. and then ticks often have deer that they can go to where they sort of finish out their lifespan, where the adult ticks go to, you know, fulfill its mission, basically, to make more ticks. So, you know, yes, it's not just climate change. It's how and where we live that are participating in this whole picture of Lyme disease.
And just to add to that, that because of, again, not as many deep forests and these small wood lots, that humans are coming into more contact more often with deer that are carrying the ticks. I wanted to take a step back right to the very beginning, that you just talked about how it is spread. What are the symptoms, the initial symptoms of Lyme disease?
Well, if you are bitten by a tick and it stays on you 24 to 48 hours, the generally accepted rule is that 36 hours is needed to impart the pathogen into your bloodstream. Some people think it's slower. But within maybe 3 to 30 days, you may get a rash. And it's often called a bullseye rash, namely a clear center with a red ring around it. But people only get the rash some 70% of the time. And those numbers often are also open to question. But I'll accept 70% of the time, which means that 30% you don't get the rash that signals you're infected. The rash also may look different. It may look like a spider bite. It may look like, very strange kind of shape. It may be totally red. So that's another reason it may be missed. The physical symptoms are fever, headache, intense fatigue, joint pain. So you may go to the doctor and say, I have these symptoms. I don't have a rash. And the doctor has to do the calculation, should I treat or should I not? And at that point in the disease, only perhaps 20 to 40% of people correctly test positive. The other 80% will be negative, even though they have the disease. So even though doctors can treat based on these symptoms, and they should treat based on these symptoms, they often will say, come back, we'll test you later to make sure, because of this whole controversy that swirls around potentially falsely diagnosing Lyme disease.
Our guest today is Mary Beth Pfeiffer, author of the new book, Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. Our phone number is 1-800-729-7532. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take some phone calls now. Jim is in East Berlin. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes, I was curious with all the inaccuracies of the testing. Is there really? I mean, you can have the symptoms of it, or not have the symptoms. Maybe have the bullseye, rash, etc. Why is the testing even? Why don't they just treat with symptoms rather than the test? Because it's going to come back with inaccurate results, apparently, regardless. And I'm also curious about what drugs they use. Is it just one type, or is there multiple type of drugs that they use to treat?
Hey, Jim, thank you very much for your call.
Well, if you go to your doctor with a rash, that in and of itself is diagnostic for Lyme disease. You should be treated. But you also should be treated if you go to the doctor and it's Lyme season, tick season. We know ticks are out. You live in a place where there are ticks. You might have had occasion to interact with the natural environment, which most of us do at some point. And if you have the symptoms that align with Lyme disease, the advice is that you should be treated. Lyme disease is a clinical diagnosis. Namely, it can be diagnosed based on your symptoms, whether you have the rash and or whether you have the symptoms that meet the threshold of being in an area where Lyme disease exists. But for a very long time, doctors have wanted to rely on the Lyme disease test. So that has been the problem. That has been the reason that many people go undiagnosed or that they are told to come back later for another test and are not treated initially. And there's a lot of Lyme advocacy groups who really are pushing this idea that has been endorsed by the Centers for Disease Control. Namely, treat Lyme according to its symptoms and not only relying on the test itself.
So how do they treat, though?
Usually it's a 10 to 28-day course of mostly doxycycline, sometimes amoxicillin. There are a number of other antibiotics that are used. Sometimes for late diagnosed cases, there will be an intravenous antibiotic used, ceftriaxone, I believe is the name. So there are a number of them, but doxycycline really is the frontline antibiotic that most people get.
And it works if caught early?
Well, it works for most people if caught early. And, you know, most that would be about 80 to 90%. The scientific literature says that 10 to 20% of properly treated people will remain ill a year after being treated with doxycycline or another frontline antibiotic. And these are the people who are treated exactly as the medical guidelines say they should be treated, and yet 10 to 20% of them remain ill.
So, and you used the term debilitating earlier in our conversation, and what kind of symptoms do you describe as debilitating?
Well, it can be intense fatigue. I mean, fatigue to the extent that you can't get up out of bed in the morning, that you have very, very little energy. You can have neurological problems, numbness and tingling, cognition issues where you can't remember things, where you have trouble speaking. other things that have been associated with Lyme disease are stroke, certainly arthritic-like manifestations, intense pain, joint pain that can last a very long time, muscle pain. Lyme disease has also been known to go to the eyes and cause eye problems, to the heart, and cause what's called Lyme carditis. This is believed to be believed to happen more frequently early in the disease, but there are some researchers who believe it can happen later on as well. So, these are things that keep people from functioning normally in many cases of lately treated, belated, diagnosed Lyme disease.
And the CDC, they're not on board with all that?
Well, again, the CDC does accept that there is something called post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. They actually have a page devoted to it on their website. But as sort of part of this whole image of Lyme disease as being easy to diagnose and easy to treat, as outlined in the care guidelines, the CDC did a very interesting thing a couple of years ago. They had said for a very long time that 10 to 20% of people with Lyme disease will have this post-treatment syndrome. And then they changed it to say, quote, unquote, a small percentage will have this syndrome. And I called them up and asked, well, why did you change that? And they pointed me to a study that was done by researchers at New York Medical College, where much of the prevailing wisdom, if you will, about Lyme disease emanates. And this study found that 5% of people would have lingering symptoms of Lyme disease. Okay, that is a small percentage. But what the CDC didn't say in changing its website was 5% would have those symptoms an average of 15 years after treatment. So, if you multiply that figure of people year after year after year based on 300,000 cases every year, that's a very, very large share of people.
Let's take a phone call from Gina in Lancaster. Gina, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I am going to parallel humans getting Lyme disease and horses. And just bear with me. I pulled a tick off my horse. This is a number of years ago. And about a month after I had done that, he started showing symptoms, some that are the same as humans. Extreme fatigue, muscle pain he had, joint aches. I had him tested for Lyme, came back like a false positive. And my vet said, we got to do another test. Tested him, came back, he had it. Put him on doxycycline. Now, he was on this for 6 months. Every month he was tested, see if he needed it. Last test he had, titers were low, but the vet told me he will always carry this. If you start to see clinical symptoms, you must call us. We'll do a blood test, and we'll put him on doxycycline right away. And my point is, there are no Lyme loonies. There just aren't. And I knew the clinical systems symptoms for him. So this is why I was always watching him. And I guess it's a comment, but it kind of, he had the same symptoms that humans did. If they have it once, they need to not think, really, again, they're Lyme loonies, because they are not. Thanks for taking my comment.
Gina, thank you for your call. Mary Beth?
I actually did an article on Lyme disease in animals, and as part of that visited a stable in this area. And the manager of the stable, in no uncertain terms, said his horses, some of them, had chronic Lyme disease. I spoke to other people, horse owners, veterinarians, who say, yes, this is a real condition in horses. It's a real risk. And I've also been told, and I didn't confirm this through my reporting, but that horses are often given prophylactic doses regularly to keep Lyme disease away because, you know, they're very valuable animals. So if it happens in animals, one must assume, and there have been studies of monkeys and mice, et cetera, that it does happen in people.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. To learn more about Lyme disease, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health. From policy to personal choices, we're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. Our guest is Mary Beth Pfeiffer, author of the new book, Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. Our phone number is 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. We have about 8 minutes left in the program. I'm going to try to get to as many calls and emails as I can. Rich, you're in Marysville. Rich, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that you don't have to go all the way to Europe or Africa to see the how climate change is moving insects and arachnids to cooler, what were formerly cooler climates. I work as a outdoor guide near Jim Thorpe, work part-time there, and I've been doing so for 30 years. I camp at 1,650 feet, and like the first 10 years I was there, no mosquitoes. About the next 10 years, we started to get them occasionally. Now they're just ubiquitous. They're just there constantly from early May to September. So that's just like the climate prediction said. Mosquitoes would move up the side of mountains, and I'm sure it does the same with ticks and any other kind of nasty bug, as you would call them.
So. Hey, Jim, thank you very much for your call. Another example of how the climate changing has had an impact, and someone who works in the outdoors and has seen some of those things.
Yes. I was really fascinated when I embarked on my book on Lyme disease. I had reported on it on a local level in the Hudson Valley, and then I sort of took this global look. And this is a huge problem around the world in many other countries. It's well entrenched in Europe with rates every bit as high as we have here in the Northeast and the Midwest. Holland, for example, Germany, Sweden, Norway, people have the same problems getting care for Lyme disease in those places as we have here. Australia, China, it's really coming on great guns.
Joanne in Mannheim asks, why is there a vaccine for Lyme disease for dogs but not for humans?
Well, we did have a vaccine for humans from 1998 to 2002. It was taken off the market because of lack of demand was the official reason by the manufacturer. But there had been reports of adverse effects on people of the vaccine. Besides this, though, it was a clunky, not very effective vaccine. You needed to get three doses. A lot of people wouldn't follow through with that. Even if you got the three doses, you stood a chance of 1 in 4 of getting Lyme disease. It was only 75% effective. There is another one in development, and it may come on the market soon. The problem with that, though, is that we cannot become complacent about ticks. You know, we may think if we get this better vaccine, if it is better, that we're protected, but we are not. Because ticks these days are carrying more than just Lyme disease. Often, or sometimes, people will get two or three illnesses in a single tick bite. Among these are babesiosis, which is on the order of malaria. It's a malaria-like parasite, so it has to be treated differently from the antibiotics that we use for Lyme disease. Anaplasmosis, there's about 6 or 7 on the list right now accepted by the CDC of pathogens that ticks carry. So we really need a vaccine that would attack the tick itself and not an individual organism like the Lyme bug.
I'm going to try to squeeze in as much as I can here in the last few minutes. With that said, if there are so many cases of Lyme disease out there and it's increasing so quickly, why hasn't Big Pharma been on this? I mean, going, you know, guns a-blazing after some kind of treatment to come up with some kind of medication, because there's lots of money to be made there. Same with researchers, if they could get grants.
Well, one would think that Big Pharma would step up. But the thing is, people who are chronically ill with the leftover effects of Lyme disease are diagnosed with other things and given other medications every bit as expensive as perhaps a cure would be for Lyme disease. So they're often given anti-inflammatory drugs. They're told they have multiple sclerosis in cases, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, depression. So it's not like these folks aren't coming to the door of Big Pharma. They're there, but they're being treated in other ways. There are indications that Big Pharma is going to become interested in this. I've had some of those privately, but be that as it may, they haven't done it yet. As far as research, the research has been dominated by the mainstream side. So you have people, very eminent scientists, who go to the National Institutes of Health with a proposal, and it's a proposal that basically contends that we've got Lyme disease wrong, and they can't get funded for their research projects because it doesn't fit into the view of Lyme disease in America.
Let's take one last call from Tina in Mechanicsburg. Tina, I understand that you're affiliated with the Pennsylvania Department of Health.
Actually, I'm a member of the board of PA Lyme Resource Network.
Okay.
And we have worked with the Department of Health to produce the Dare to be Tick Aware campaign. So we actually have literature online at www.palyme.org. It includes a tick ID card that lists all the different the top ticks and the top diseases they're carrying, as well as easy prevention brochures to follow. Protecting yourself from ticks is just like protecting yourself from the sun. You go out, you spray yourself, you spray your clothes. It takes just 1 minute to protect yourself, especially your children and your pets. And we actually have a special brochure on tick-proofing your yard and taking care of your pets and yourself when you're outdoors.
I'm glad you called in. Thank you very much for your call. We have about 2 minutes left. Let's see. Christina's in Lancaster. Christina, probably not going to be able to get to your call, but I'll ask your question. Any research about the people who were tested for the original three types of Lyme were negative, then retested and found to have one of the other seven varieties?
I don't really understand the question, but there are different species and genospecies, subtypes of the Lyme bug in circulation. Perhaps that's what this person is referring to. You know, it is believed that some cases may be missed because they simply aren't captured by the test that we have in terms of the organism that the person is carrying. It's slightly different genetically or structurally than the typical Borrelia burgdorferi bug.
Last year, a listener asked, news reported that smaller ticks and small mammals such as field mice carried Lyme disease, not the deer ticks. Are deer ticks not Lyme carriers?
Well, the deer tick is the same word or label as for a black-legged tick. That's really the correct way to refer to these ticks are black-legged ticks. They're called deer ticks because they have long been carried by deer. But deer are really not most significant player in this whole hierarchy of Lyme disease. Mice are where the ticks get infected. You know, a tick will bite a mouse and get infected 90% of the time. When a tick bites a deer, it will only become infected 10% of the time.
Mary,
so deer, go ahead.
I was going to say, Mary Beth, we're out of time, but since you just brought that up, if I am bitten by a tick, what's the percentage of time I get Lyme disease?
Well, it's believed to be in the medical literature about 4% of the time there. Again, as with anything else with Lyme, there's debate about it.
The book, and it's just been published, Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. Mary Beth Pfeiffer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Obviously a big topic here in Pennsylvania. Coming up tomorrow, Harrisburg Mayor Eric Papenfuss will be with us.